And we're back. This is episode 6 of Taking It Slow. I have a bit of a desire to get caught up on having missed a couple of opportunities to do some talking about and reacting to the league because of the holidays. Had a lot of folks at my home over the holidays, family and such, keeping me busy. So I wasn't able to get down and sit down and kind of react to the current state of the league. So I'm going to take the opportunity now to go ahead and do that. This recording is being done in the 2018 season between Sims 5 and 6. So we're maybe a hair less than halfway through the season. We'll be a hair more than halfway through the season after Sim 6, but I think it's probably fair halfway through the season to say we have a pretty good idea of what teams are and who they are and what they look like. And since Horns and Fangs did a good job at going over the teams that are either in the playoffs or just outside the playoff race, I thought it might be a little more interesting to take a look at the teams that are outside the playoff picture, and not you know, like the 76ers and Wizards still definitely have a chance to get in, but probably looking at the bottom 12 teams or so in the league and assessing where they are and what they're doing and what their prospects are. I mentioned in Taking It Slow episode 5 that I did a look at the league over the past 20 years, and in general it looks like bottoming out takes 2 to 3 seasons, and then in about the fourth season you start seeing the teams really come back on the upswing on the average. So with that, let's take a look at some of the teams here, and I'm going to start with the Oklahoma City Thunder. They're currently 15-23. That puts them on a pace to be just over 30 wins for the season, so they don't quite get to my tanking criterion of 30 wins or fewer. And you know, the Thunder, I think they're in an interesting spot. They've got a core that is, you know, aging, with the exception of Jabari Parker, who they just re-upped in free agency. And I noticed a couple of Sims ago that Make It Rain put on the block that, you know, obviously this core isn't working. He's putting his core up for trade and going to see what he can get. So you've got Nikola Vucevic, Isaiah Thomas, Jabari Parker, and if you want to consider them part of the core, maybe a Jordan Hill or an Omri Caspi, but neither one of them is super productive anymore. I mean, I take that back. Caspi is still putting up 15 points and 7 rebounds, but he's definitely on the downswing of his career. Obviously, they're not going to be able to trade Jabari Parker this season because he was a restricted free agent. So let's take him off the table right away. That leaves us with Isaiah Thomas and Nikola Vucevic. Isaiah is still extremely productive. He's, as of this recording, putting up 24.5 points, 8.8 assists, and 1.8 steals. So you would think, you know, he would be a guy that has some value. I think it's going to be difficult to find a match for his $26.5 million salary, however. And since the Thunder are, you know, not in a horrible spot cap-wise, or a couple, you know, maybe $1 million, $1.5 million under the cap, it's not like they have to move him just to dump salary. And I kind of suspect, as I kind of mentioned in the last podcast, that the market for players 29, 30 years old and older on big contracts is very, very depressed lately, even expiring ones. Teams are not willing to take a player on a big expiring contract unless they're getting something in return, even a good one. And since there's not a lot of pressure for the Oklahoma City Thunder to move Isaiah Thomas based on luxury tax status, because they're going to wind up below the apron, assuming they stay healthy-ish anyway, and they even have space to sign one or two more players if they do get injuries. So there's just not an urgency built in on the part of the Thunder. And I don't suspect he wants to take pennies on the dollar. And the other problem is, you know, you've got an expiring contract. If teams are going to try to undersell you on what they're sending back, they're going to be sending contracts that are longer term and probably for players that aren't as good. So I really don't see a great move opening up for the Thunder. I think they're going to have to ride this season out, let Vucevic and Isaiah Thomas fall off the books and kind of build the old-fashioned way around Jabari Parker. Vucevic's contract, $15 million contract, and being only 28, so he's got, you know, 2-3 more good years left in him, may be a little more attractive, so they might be able to get something for him. But my concern, if I'm another team, is, okay, here's a 28-year-old blue. We saw what Greg Monroe got in the last market. That's a max. Am I really going to give you that much for a guy that I'm either going to have to max or lose after this season? So it might be a little easier to find a match as far as salary goes for Vucevic. But as far as talent goes, I'm not sure you're going to get much back for him. Teams are going to be very reluctant to give up talent for an older player that's going to cost them a lot of money. So again, I think, you know, for better or for worse, the Thunder are kind of stuck where they're at. I talked a little bit about this on the previous podcast, whereby if you're going to get really, really good, you have to get really, really bad first. And that means, you know, I kind of set that watermark at 30 wins. You need to get under 30 wins if you're going to go over 50 wins. And right now, if you look back at the Thunder's last few years, 38 wins, 39, 39, 42, 36, they're in that limbo state where they're not willing to give up future assets to go all in, and they're not willing to get bad enough to tank ever since they picked up Parker. So I think, you know, is Parker good enough to keep the Thunder in playoff contention on his own? No. But since they're going to be able to reset their cap, I think there's a possibility that the Thunder are in no man's land. They're in that limbo where they're not good enough to compete, but they're not bad enough to stockpile talent. So if I were guessing based on past experience, I would think that the Thunder will keep trying to put pieces together and trying to compete and try to build themselves up, but I don't think that that's going to be possible without moving Parker, even though he's only 23, and really, really bottoming out before coming back. So we'll see if they're able to manage something next season, but I don't think we really can get a clear idea on where they're going until Parker is no longer held by that restricted free agent tag. So I think this season is probably another disappointment for the Thunder. They'll wind up out of the playoffs. They'll probably get a low lottery pick, and that sets them up to repeat again next year to do the same thing. The difference is next year at least they have the chance to reshuffle their roster. Maybe they can get some players on contracts that'll be a little more able to be traded. The next team to look at is the Warriors. They're 14-23. It's been touched on that Ben kind of set this team up to go on autopilot for a couple years, or cruise control, or whatever you want to call it. And honestly, he did a pretty good job in every way except cap, in that, you know, he got a group of young players together and got a core of guys that was all signed, so he didn't have to really worry about free agency for a year or two. He's been running with the same core the last couple of years now, and a lot of them are even signed in through next year. I mean, the only big decisions he's going to have this offseason, are Brian Stark, who I'm pretty sure he's going to want to bring back, and Kyle Lowry, who is 32 and is coming off a $36 million contract. He's not going to re-up Kyle for anything close to that. He's likely to be close to the cap next year unless he comes back in and declines Bazemore's team option. But, you know, if he give Stark any amount of money, that puts him, you know, back up against the cap between Stark, Gobert, and then the Beverly and the Henson contracts. So, again, this is a team that isn't bad enough to be bad, and without a GM really active, they're not going to be able to sell off pieces to get really bad just yet. So they may be stuck in mediocrity for another, you know, season or two. Now, if Ben comes back, obviously he can change course, but in terms of natural progression, assuming there's no massive attempt to sell things off or massive attempt to sell off future assets for current ones, I think the Warriors are kind of on the downslide, but they're not ready to rebuild yet, which means they're not ready to bounce back yet. As I mentioned, they're stuck in mediocrity land. So that's where the Warriors are. There's not really a lot more to say about them, you know, with the inactivity of their owner. And so, you know, if you're looking to pick up players, Warriors are probably not the best place to look. You do worry if Gobert's prime is going to be wasted there, but you know, like I said, Ben did a good job, though, of setting the team up, so he really didn't have to do a whole lot for a couple of seasons. He had enough contracts where he'd kind of let it slide, but I would hope he would check back in before the off season to make sure Brian Stark and Bazemore are dealt with in a timely manner. Which takes us to the 10th worst team in the league, the Chicago Bulls. They are 11-24, and I'll be honest, I was kind of surprised that they sold into a rebuilding process. But, you know, the future looks bright in Chicago. You look over their roster, they've got, you know, Bismack Biyombo is on a big contract. I didn't like the Bismack contract that he was on before, which was a max. Now he's on, just eyeballing it, 60% of a max, which I guess could be right for his defense. But you really wish you were getting more offense out of him than 9 points a game. And with seven rebounds, he's not really that great a defender either. So I wonder if Bismack is a guy that, you know, people looked at and, you know, thought he can do a lot of stuff based on color. But based on productivity, he's just not getting it done. And, you know, I kind of touched in the previous episode of Taking It Slow on with veteran guys, you want to look more at production necessarily than potential. And Biyombo is only 26, but he's on his third contract. He's had his rookie deal, he's had his RFA contract, now he's on a UFA contract. And to be quite honest, that puts him in the camp of being a veteran, and he has not produced the way you would hope. So he's a guy that, you know, I think the Bulls would be willing to cut bait on if they could find a taker. And you know, at 26, he's not going to get worse necessarily for another 3-4 years, so maybe they decide to hang on to him. It's just a matter of, you know, how cluttered is your cap going to be. You've got T.J. Warren, you've got Biyombo, you've got Victor Oladipo, Charles Simmons and Vernon DeSantis are on moderate deals, but that's still, you know, with that, plus Doug McDermott, I mean, they've eaten their cap up. At least for the next couple of seasons. They, you know, a little bit of flexibility, but nothing to bring in a real game changer based on offering a big contract. You can bring in a game changer if you get lucky, like, you know, the Wizards did a couple of years ago with T-Mac on a min, but that's definitely not a way to plan your franchise. The good news is that, you know, they've got Vernon DeSantis, who's 21. They've got Phil Milburn, 21. T.J. Warren, 25, Victor Oladipo, 26, Dennis Smith Jr., 21. So they've got their young core in place. Warren and Oladipo are probably ready now. Dennis Smith and Vernon DeSantis are probably one more year away, and Phil Milburn's probably 2 years away. But you can see their core in place, and you know where this team is going, at least as far as the personnel goes. What I'm not sure about where this team is going, and maybe Josh can address this on an episode of Horns and Fangs, is where they expect, or where he expects this team to grow into a stronger team. Right now they're kind of middle of the pack in field goal percentage. They're not good at all at free throw shooting, and so, you know, that may be an issue. You know, rebounding, they're a little weak. You know, obviously scoring doesn't help with shooting. Steals are not great, so defensively they could use some work. And as I take a look at their players, you know, I'm assuming that he's hoping Milburn and DeSantis grow into their A potentials in rebounding. But steals, you know, as far as turnovers go, you know, Oladipo and Dennis Smith Jr. have A's. But if you look at, you know, if you look at how they're performing, even with those two players already in the A range in the 80s, they're just, you know, they're not doing anything. So maybe that's something that can be fixed with game plan. I don't know. Yeah, I think the Bulls are ready to be patient. I know they've shopped Oladipo around a little bit, and I suspect that's mostly due to trying to sync up the age window on their stars. Oladipo is a productive player now, puts up points, a decent number of rebounds and assists, given his size, and puts up steals. So, you know, is he a dominating scorer? No, but he certainly does enough to keep everybody honest. And I think he has the chance to, you know, be a really, really good player for another 3-4 years. So if he is able to locate a team that wants to win now, and Oladipo's contract, yes, it's a max, but it's one of the low 25% maxes as opposed to one of the higher maxes that you get as players get older. So I think he's definitely a trade chip they can do something with. But even if they don't and they kind of keep the course with this core, they're going to have to re-up Milburn this year, and that is going to be tough on them financially. And then they have to up DeSantis the year after that. So the talent's there, and the age windows are about right. But, you know, this goes back to luxury tax and salary cap management. They've done a good job of staggering when they're going to have to pay their players, but the staggering starts after this season. And so they need to, if I were them, I would be trying to find a taker for Oladipo, maybe for some expiring salary plus a young piece. I think, you know, Oladipo's age and talent merit that. And, you know, maybe reset their tax next season, because if they are not able to reset the tax next season, they're going to have to start shedding pieces, you know, maybe involuntarily. And I'm sure Josh is aware of that, and that's probably why Oladipo's been on the block. But I think, you know, the Bulls have a bright future. The only, you know, tricky water for them to navigate is going to be cap management. So speaking of cap management, we can move into the Toronto Raptors, who are 11-28. Toronto, you know, got bit a couple of years ago by their cap or their luxury tax payment getting so high they couldn't get it paid off, and that kind of decimated their team. They've made a very good comeback since. I've been very impressed with how Wave has stockpiled not blue-chip talent, no pun intended, but green-chip talent, if you will. He's got a great stable of younger big men, from Thomas Bedard to Boris Hailey to Jarvis Chambers to Refugio Lozano, who are all green potential. They're yellow now. They're starting to, you know, figure out how the piece is put together. Obviously, he brought back Zach LaVine to build around him in RFA. He's still got Goran Dragic on the roster. That's kind of an anchor on his cap, but that's going to go away after this season. And, of course, he's got, you know, Louis Stevens and Baratheon. I don't know how to pronounce the name. I don't watch Game of Thrones. So he's got guys at every position, albeit a little bit undersized, that he can count on growing going forward. And he's also in the enviable position of retaining all of his own draft picks. And so, you know, if you figured last season was the first season he bottomed out, and this season is the second season that he might be gunning for that sub-30 lineup, he's now got the depth, and he's got the youth, and he's got the draft picks to start pulling himself back up. And he's done a good job of aligning his salaries such that, you know, next season he may want to pay to bring back Refugio Lozano, but that will still leave him with probably a max slot open. And if he doesn't like anything there, he can kick the can down the road again to 2020. You know, Thomas Bedard is a good player, but he's not going to command a max. So, you know, a lot of his front court players come back up then. But he's got a 2-year window to add stuff around the edges on this team before he has to start paying people. So I think, you know, as long as he's able to add one more solid player, preferably like a blue potential guy in the front court, he's got the depth that he needs to make a run, you know, coming out of that dip in his team cycle. So I'll gone through the first 4 out of the 12 teams I was looking at covering. We're about 20 minutes in, so I'll take a quick break and we'll come back and move through the rest of them.
Here at Arthur Daniels Heartland, we work every day to make your life livable in ways you don't appreciate. We make sure the sun comes up every morning. We get your children to school safely, and we print the books they use in class. We've put a man on the moon.
We have liftoff.
We've taken apart your lawnmower.
Hey, get away from that!
We're here to help you, despite what you've heard. We feed millions of people around the world, and we provide Wink Martindale's wardrobe. At ADH, we read your mail.
Oh.
Arthur Daniels Heartland. If we told you who we are, we'd have to kill you. So just keep moving along. There's nothing to see here. Go on. Go on. Get out. What are you looking at?
All right. Well, we are back. And let's keep a move to our lotto teams. Moving to the Bucks, who are 10-28. Currently sitting in last in the Central Division. The Bucks are in the middle of another one of Doug's premature rebuilds. I know Nick gets a lot of grief for blowing teams up, but Doug has a tendency to hit the reset button more often, I think, than most other owners. I know when I was going back and looking at kind of the cycles of the league, the Bucks seem to have one of the shortest cycles between peaks, but they also have one of the shortest cycles between valleys. So Doug is very good at taking his assets and taking existing players and getting a whole bunch of young pieces for them. And then once he finds the piece or two he wants to build around, he'll then convert all those young pieces and picks back into players that help him now. And as I opened up his team page, I'm not terribly surprised to notice he has 7 first-round picks over the next 3 years. And so he's got a team that has a lot of good pieces. Most of them are young. I think once he decides whether or not Elfrid Payton, as a restricted free agent, is meeting his expectations, he will, you know, make a move on whether to keep or expel him next season. And then, you know, I think his other piece is hoping that Damian McNary finally starts living up to his potentials. And he's getting close. McNary is currently leading the Bucks in scoring. He's averaging 17.4 points a game, pulling down 7.3 boards a game. That also leads the team. So McNary is producing. He's not quite ready yet. But that kind of goes back to, you know, what I mentioned in the previous podcast, that what we're seeing with the college players is you start getting production from most of your college players that, you know, don't get hit by training camp or weren't that good to begin with right around year 4, just as they're coming off of the end of their rookie contract. And so McNary is no exception. I think Doug is, and this is just based on, you know, kind of the way he's talked on Skype, the way he's talked on the forums, I think he's pretty happy with the way that McNary is playing, and he sees McNary as the piece he's going to build around in the future. He's got a lot of, you know, smaller contracts, so he can do a good job mixing and matching when he's ready to trade, and not a lot of big money committed long term. So, again, the Bucks are probably one of the best teams in the league when it comes to doing a quick rebuild. So I think what Doug is planning on doing is to see how his draft pick falls this season, add another player. I would suspect next season is going to be shuffling the decks, because he's going to have to pay McNary in this offseason. Then he's got quite a bit of money coming off the off the books. I don't think he's going to pay Alton Towers or Charles Tardif a max, and those are the only two rotation players getting significant minutes that I think he sees as a part of as potentially part of the team long term. Al Jefferson is getting a lot of minutes, but he's 34, so he's kind of the exception to the rule there. And at that point, I'm sure Doug is hoping he has a better read on what Shelvin Durbin will be, on what Aubrey Broomfield will be. It's a team that has a lot of front court players already in place in terms of youth, and not as many backcourt players, which is actually kind of a clever move on Doug's part. One of the things that's been a pretty big topic over the last week or so has been the heights of college players. And, you know, when we wound up taking a look at it empirically, we discovered, you know, the college players are maybe an inch or two shorter than your average NBA-generated player. So the problem is maybe overblown. But if you take a look, also, and I don't know if anybody else noticed this, and I'm going to go off on a tangent here just for a minute. Did anybody else notice that Scott posted the college top 50 in the college area? And when I looked at the college top 50, one of the things that jumped out at me is that this class actually has a lot of size relative to what we've seen before. You know, just doing a quick rundown of the top 10, you've got a 7'2 center, 6'5 small forward, that's a little on the small side, 6'7 center, 6'5 point guard, 6'9 center, 6'11 center, 6'6 shooting guard, 6'8 power forward. You've got a 6'2 point guard, 6'9 power forward, 6'5 shooting guard, 6'5 small forward, 6'9 small forward, 6'7 small forward, 6'10 power forward. So for all of the concern that we've had going on about size in the draft class, this actually looks like a big draft class in terms of just size of the players. So that, to me, in and of itself, is interesting, is that, you know, maybe in the first two, three classes, we got, you know, a slightly smaller draft class than we might expect, or maybe we're getting one that's a little bit bigger this time around. But what it means is you've got a lot of guys in the league that are a little on the smaller side right now coming from the college ranks, which is where our young players are now going to be drawn from. A lot of wings, a lot of shooting guards, a lot of point guards. So Doug has set himself up nicely by collecting bigs when there weren't a whole lot of them. And so now he sets himself up to be able to negotiate from a position of strength. If you have bigs when there aren't a lot of them, you can command a better shooting guard or small forward when you're getting rid of one of your excess bigs. So, again, Doug has done a good job of looking forward to that. And, you know, the other thing that will be interesting to watch is how quick he moves his picks next season. He's got the Suns pick and he's got the Mavericks pick, and the Suns have kind of been spinning their wheels, and I think, you know, they're ahead of the Pacific Division now, but I think they would like to, you know, with putting Kevin Love on the block, they're getting into the mind of we need to do a reset. They don't have really much young talent at all. And so if he moves Love, I'm sure Doug will be holding on to that piece for dear life. Or, you know, maybe Doug, you offer that pick if Kevin Love comes back, you know, just a thought. And then the other pick he has is the Mavericks pick, and the Mavericks have done a nice job with a slow build, but, you know, their guys are getting up there too. They're still focused on Bradley Beal. They've got rookie Rubio in the fold now, as well as Josh Smith. But the Mavericks, I don't think, are built long-term. And if Doug agrees that they're not going to do great next year, he might want to hold on to that pick a little bit longer. So, you know, will be interesting to see how the Bucks play that, you know, those draft picks out. Those are draft picks that could go either way, depending on how free agency goes. So, you know, what the Bucks do with those draft picks, I think, really will speak a lot to how he feels, anyway, the Suns and the Mavericks are going to go. And I suspect he'll move at least one of those picks to try to get some, you know, some more young talent in there. But again, you know, the Bucks are probably in year one of a 2-year slide before they cash in all their young pieces and build back up, you know, to try to take a swing at AD, because I think, you know, that's kind of what precipitated Doug to launch into selling off assets. And AD, once he gets off of his current deal and moves on to an even more enormous third deal, it'll be very difficult to get talent around him. And I kind of suspect that Doug is waiting for that as his moment to pounce, not because he thinks he can necessarily be better than AD, but he thinks he can be better than AD surrounded by subpar talent. So I guess Doug can weigh in on that. The next team we could look at would be the 14-23 Golden State Warriors. I talked about the Warriors already a little bit. The 10-29 Spurs. I was looking at who held the pick rather than who had the record. So the Spurs at 10-29 are in the first year of a real rebuild, and Easy has done a very good job of tearing things down to the bone. You know, he's still got players that he could conceivably move for more assets. Mark Gasol is still a quality player. You know, in 30 minutes a game, looks like he's averaging almost 10 points and 8 boards and 3 assists. So, you know, is he a top-of-the-line starter? No. Is he a high-grade backup or a low-grade starter? Absolutely. Is that worth a first-round pick? Probably not. Is it worth a second-round pick and points? Yeah, could be. He's got Gasol. He's got Danilo Gallinari, who's still very potent offensively, averaging 22 points a game, and Dennis Schroeder is averaging 20. So he's got a couple of 20-point-a-game scorers that I'm sure, you know, don't fit with his long-term plans. Yeah, maybe Schroeder does, but I think, you know, the idea behind the Spurs for this season is to flip guys and just accumulate points, accumulate picks, and start, you know, for lack of a better word, start their tank. The one caveat there is the Spurs do not have their own pick this season. Obviously, that resides with the Warriors. It might take them one additional year to start reaping the benefits of tanking. So I think, you know, if you were to ask me, you know, when do the Spurs start coming out of their rebuild, I would guess probably after the 2020 season. You know, they'll have had 2019 and 2020 to be bad and get their own draft picks after those seasons. And they've got, you know, after the season after that, in 2021, they're currently sitting on the Magic, Pelicans, and Nets picks. So they'll have a lot of draft picks to play with if they want to bring players on after that. So that, you know, if I'm a betting man, I think the Spurs are probably in for a bumpy couple of years. It doesn't help that, you know, they've got that big 112-point luxury tax bill to pay off. But, you know, once they get that paid off, and I think it'll take them another season or two, they'll be able to start moving forward again. And then we'll see, you know, 12 more years of Spur, who knows. Moving along to the Lakers. The Lakers recently had Trey resign. We've had the stewards running them. They did make one trade whereby Brandon Jennings went out the door. Without getting too deep into the stewards' thought process, this is probably something that everybody can agree on. You know, the opinion of the stewards is really what you need to do with the Lakers is start considering this a rebuild around Giannis Antetokounmpo and Gustave Lacroix. And Lacroix, you know, kind of as I mentioned earlier, he's in his fourth year. He's averaging 17 points, Yeah, he averaged 17 points last year, so we're seeing, again, that production start coming into play. He's, you know, probably going to be due for a big raise. You know, Giannis has that big contract from being an RFA last season. So, the thought process for the Lakers was, you know, accumulate assets. You know, you're probably going to have two guys that you're going to have to pay in Antetokounmpo and in LaCroix, but leave room for whoever takes over with Lakers to have several young pieces and picks to work with. and not so worried about this season. Just kind of position yourself to do better. Getting rid of Brandon Jennings and getting Kevin Kowal in gets rid of a big contract and brings in, at least going forward. Obviously, the Valanciunas contract kind of nulls it out this year. But going forward, you have the opportunity to let Kowal kind of grow and blossom and hopefully become a piece you can use. I don't think anybody expects him to become a star piece, but if he can be a sixth man or a fifth starter, that would be terrific. Also, putting a plug out there, since the trade deadline is coming up soon, the Lakers do have plenty of cap space. So as long as you're sending expiring contracts and some sort of asset, whether it be points or picks, that's something the stewards will definitely be looking for. They're not necessarily looking to load up with blue talent, but loading up with a couple of yellows that might have a chance to pop, that might be something we could look at. And of course, points and picks are always appreciated because those are flexible assets for any new owner to use coming in. And finally, for this little bit, we'll take a look at the Celtics, who are 9-27 and sitting in last place in the Atlantic. The Celtics are coming off of seasons of 26 wins, 16 wins, and 16 wins. So it's been a little rough going for them of late, but they now have D'Angelo Russell, they have Karl Anthony Towns, they have Tyler Ulis. They were able to pick up Isaiah Stump in free agency. They've got Jason Fisher, Melvin McCall, Reggie Bullock. So they have a nice stable of young talent. Jeff Withey, I think, has surprised a lot of people, not just me, with how many shots he's blocking this season. He's hit the blocks leaderboards a couple times on the highlights from the last sim pages, and he's averaging 2.8 blocks a game in just 25 minutes. So that's, he's 28. He probably doesn't fit with the timeline of the rest of the Celtics team. If Conroy isn't shopping him, he probably should be. And, he's on a pretty decent contract, all things considered, a $5.5 million contract for 1 year. So, he's a guy. Okay, so this brings up another point. When you're trading for guys, are you worried about how much they're going to sign for? And, the thing with Withey is he's a guy that I will be very interested to see how the league values this season. Because, he kind of snuck under the radar when he re-signed with the Celtics. He's averaged 3 blocks last year, 2.5 blocks plus this year. So he's clearly a competent shot blocker. How much does the league pay for a rim protector who's a little bit offensively challenged? I mean, he'll keep defensives honest. He's averaging 8 points a game, but he's not a great rebounder. He's not a great scorer. What's his value? I think it's probably more than $5.5 million. It's obviously not a max, but when you're hitting free agency, this is a guy that if you come up with the right valuation and then maybe add, $1 or $2 million so that your bid is a little more than everybody else's, he's a guy you can get that can be productive in a niche for you. So if I'm the Celtics, I'm probably trying to move him just because I don't think I want to pay him quite what the market is going to give. But maybe Conroy does want to keep him because he's still got a couple more seasons before all of his young guys start coming off the books and he has to pay him. So, we'll be very interested to see the way Celtics go. And then, of course, the Celtics also have, $35 million or so in cap space for absorbing stuff. So, again, another team where if you're looking to get under that luxury tax line, I'm sure Conroy's your man. So, do I think the Celtics will be good in the near future? Well, I mentioned that it takes teams about 3 years, 2 years of losing and then 1 year of kind of coming back up. It'll be interesting to see if they're, up in that 44 win category like teams usually are after 2 years of badness next season. I think the answer is no. I think just because of how raw Ulis and Karl Anthony Towns are, it might take a season longer. I wasn't thrilled with the Melvin McCall pick. I think he's a little bit limited as a player. Very good scorer, don't get me wrong, but doesn't bring a whole lot of other stuff to the table. So maybe that makes things a little difficult. and that cost him a year on that, you know, loop up timeline. But yeah, we'll see. A lot of it depends on how fast Karl-Anthony Towns and D'Angelo Russell and Tyler Ulis pick up in training camp. And, you know, with, you know, the rookie trainings, that's something that the Celtics, I'm sure, are playing these guys a lot so that they can take advantage of and get them up to speed sooner. You know, which is kind of another nice thing, I think, with the current rookie training system is, you know, these teams that do, you know, go down into the tank and play their young guys a whole lot of minutes, you do get that reward of being able to have them reach their potentials faster, which I think, you know, is realistic. And, you know, do we maybe want to revisit the complexity of that system? You know, we got a lot of other conversations going on now, so it may not be the time, but I think sometime in the future trying to simplify is good. That's almost a tangent for another episode of Taking It Slow, so I'll keep it at that. But one of the things that I really think would be a good idea to think about as a league is what are ways in which we can simplify? Our members are getting busier. You know, people are having kids. People are changing jobs. People are graduating from school, getting married. You know, in my case, things are getting a little bit easier as my kids are, you know, in their teen years. I don't have to worry about, you know, feeding them and changing diapers anymore. They're fairly self-sufficient. But I know a lot of the league is, you know, a few years behind me. So something to think about. So I'm going to take another quick break, come back, and we'll get the final four in terms of our lottery teams, and we'll start wrapping up and looking forward this afternoon soon.
Oh, I guess I'll just say it. Sweetie, will you marry...
The average human passes wind 11 times a day. But now there's an answer to the embarrassment. The Fart and Burp Buddy. The Fart and Burp Buddy is a tiny pouch that emits a lifelike scream when you squeeze it, diverting attention away from your loud flatulation or belch. Let's rewind and see just how the Fart and Burp Buddy can work.
Sweetie, will you marry...
Oh my God, look, it's John Travolta!
Honey, someone said they saw John Travolta!
Oh, it was probably just some crazy lady. Now, Schnuggums, will you marry me?
Yes, Tom, I will.
Just one little squeeze and the Fart and Burp Buddy can help you out of any cheese-cutting jam. It fits right in your pocket or purse and comes with over 100 attention-diverting phrases programmed right inside. Just listen to a few of these examples.
Look, it's Menudo! Oh no, the building's on fire! Watch out for that UFO!
The Fart and Burp Buddy even comes in foreign models, like the German.
Cross Gott, es ist David Hasselhoff.
Or how about the French?
Zutador, il est Jerry Lewis.
The Fart and Burp Buddy. From the makers of Flatusense, the scented suppositories.
All right, time to come down the home stretch. So what we're taking a look at now are the LA Clippers. They are currently in fourth place in the Pacific at 7-29. The LA Clippers can pretty much be described as Kevin Durant and a whole bunch of schlock. And part of that is because their GM kind of jumped on right at free agency. It's probably the worst time to jump in as a GM simply because you have a hard time valuing players. You have a hard time maybe getting a chance to get trades done prior to free agency to build the team the way you want it. So I do feel for Trilotto in this sense, and hopefully he's, you know, getting some good advice from folks. I don't expect the Clippers will be able to pull out of it this season, which is unfortunate, you know, as well that they don't have their draft pick. The good news for them is, you know, other than KD, they and Rodney Hood, they don't have a ton of money, you know, that isn't team options, so they can kind of shed this team, which obviously hasn't worked out the way they've hoped, and try again. The concern I would have if I'm the Clippers is Kevin Durant is 30. Yes, he's a great player, but his contract is going to be $40 million next year and $44.5 million the year after that. You don't have your own draft pick this season, so you're not going to get help after a bad season this season. what are your odds of adding players in free agency? Well, I think, you know, with a little better chance to get ready and more time in the league, he'll probably be able to put a better team around KD, but probably not a great one. And so the question becomes, and I know he said he's not going to be the one, you know, to trade Kevin Durant this year, and I think that's fair. I think it's probably not a good idea for a new GM to consider moving a star. But I think as we get toward the off season and into next season, that's the time when he needs to look at, you know, pulling the ripcord and offering to trade Kevin Durant, put it out there and see what he can get for him. And what is Kevin Durant going to command on the open market? Probably not as much as he should, just because of that enormous salary number, and also because I think there was the perception earlier in Durant's career that he could haul a team to the finals on his own. And clearly, you know, this season has shown that is no longer the case. So the Clippers, I think, are a lot, a lot closer to starting a rebuild process than they are to coming out of it, which is probably fair because they've been fighting for the division crown in the Pacific pretty much for the last 6-7 years. So they're nearing the end of their natural life cycle anyway. And so it becomes a question of, you know, how much is Otto going to be able to get for Kevin Durant, and when does he pull the trigger? And, you know, the longer he waits, obviously, the less he's going to be able to get. And you would have hoped he could have gotten a better team around him to prevent this a little longer, but this is going to be one of those situations where, welcome to the league, you're going to have to sell off a terrific player, and you're going to have to suck for 3 or 4 seasons, which is not a great position to put a new owner in, but unfortunately it kind of comes with, you know, with where Burns had left the team. You know, Burns had done a good job of constantly bringing in veterans, you know, whether it's Roy Hibbert or others to keep around KD, but he never built up the youth that you kind of need to have. And again, not necessarily high draft picks. Often it's taking, you know, a bunch of low draft picks and just hoping, you know, at some point one of them pops, and then you kind of stash him aside and trade him for other assets. I think there are some interesting pieces on the Lakers right now. What would I do if I were trying to game plan right now to win more games? Honestly, I would just go full on. I'm sorry, if I were the Clippers, try to win more games, I would go full on offense. He's got some underutilized pieces. Jay Adkins with a great strength and inside rating. Roger Conlon, great strength and inside rating. Isaiah Kanan out there for some three-point shooting. Rodney Hood can provide some three-point shooting, although I've never been a fan, really, of Hood. The other thing that the Lakers absolutely, or Lakers, why do I keep saying Lakers? Anyway, the other thing the Clippers absolutely lack is any semblance of defensive rebounding. KD has a defensive rebounding rating of 65. Their next highest player is 47. All of their centers are in the 30s. And sure enough, if you go looking at rebounding, they're the second worst team in the league in terms of rebound differential. So how do the Clippers turn it around? Probably can't do it this year, but maybe, you know, if you scour the free agent wire and, you know, try to find some guys with a good defensive rebound rating, you know, maybe that helps stop the bleeding a little bit. You know, a Lavoy Allen who's bounced around a little bit, maybe a Mitch McGarry. But, you know, the Clippers are coming off several 50-win seasons. This is going to be their first one going into the tank, and I think they're going to be down for a little while. This season isn't being caused to be down by injuries. It's because the cupboard has been left bare around KD, and they're going to have to start restocking. The Kings, on the other hand, who are in fifth place in the Pacific, do not need to restock their cupboard nearly as much. They have a bunch of young players, a lot of potential. I mentioned in my previous podcast, Tanny, and probably Doug, is one of the best in the league at doing a fast rebuild, where he sells off all his assets, gets premium picks and youth for them, and then is able to turn it around and build right back up in a hurry. And I think this is one of those cases. You know, the Kings have their own pick and they have the Clippers pick, so they're looking at two top five picks in this draft. That'll match nicely with Ronald Small and with Jeffrey Duren. They've got James Pearsall in the wings. Tyron Ferris and Arthur Hardy. I actually loved Ferris. I wanted to try to find a way to pick him the year he was drafted. I just couldn't manage to finagle my way into that pick, you know, to add him to the roster. But I think he's got some solid pieces, and you know, he's probably a year ahead of the game in terms of, you know, when you're tanking, you might have one young piece that's raw and not ready yet. Duren is showing that he's not at his potential yet, but he's already productive. And so I think, you know, the Kings are a year ahead of schedule in terms of putting things back together. So they'll probably be bad one more year, and then look for them in 2020 to pop, especially because that's about the time I figure Duren will probably grow into himself. Pearsall will start becoming productive. And the one thing that I always find interesting is often with these young teams, you have four, five, or six, you know, really good players that are young and on rookie contracts, and that's great. And it'll be interesting to see in two or three years when they have to pay everybody, who do they get rid of? Because you can't, you know, roll with six maxes. It'll destroy you cap-wise. So you watch these teams, and one or two of their really good players, they have to kind of send off, and you just hope they make the right decision. Instead of like real life Sam Presti sending off James Harden because he wanted to pay Serge Ibaka. So now to the top two, the Jazz, who've had, you know, back-to-back Rookie of the Year campaigns, probably coming out of Joseph Kite, and then this year, you know, I think there's a very good chance that you could see, you know, Deshaun Hawkins, putting up good numbers, but the guy who's really going to be, you know, in the conversation for Rookie of the Year is James Gebhardt. So the Jazz have, you know, players with nice potential. They're getting production now. I mean, Kite is averaging 20 points a game this season. Gebhardt's averaging 19. So all their production is coming from young players. It's not translating into wins yet. But I think as these players grow into their potentials, the Jazz have a very solid foundation. They, you know, probably are a center away, you know, a true center away from really being scary. And they're kind of in the same boat the Clippers are. They just got rid of Russell Arcinaga, who was the only thing that closely resembles a rebounder on their team. So if you look at their defensive rebounding, they are just getting destroyed. They're the only team worse than the Clippers because none of their guys that's in their regular rotation has much of a rebounding presence at all. I'm looking real quick at the team page here. Christopher Bechtel, how many minutes is he getting? He's getting 6 minutes. He's got a 50 in defensive rebounding. Robbie Cordova is getting 10 minutes. He's got a 43 in defensive rebounding. Brendan Brisson, getting 25 minutes as their starting center. He's their best, you know, regular rotation player, and his defensive rebounding rating is 36. So you know why the Jazz are bad. It comes down to rebounding. What they need is a, you know, a monster center, maybe a Rudy Gobert type, if they can get Ben to respond and get him in there to solid up the middle, because they're getting annihilated down low, and that's what's causing them to be as bad as they are. And you know, once they do that, and you know, one thing I will say about the Jazz is Gary is super enthusiastic. Really love the enthusiasm he brings, and he hasn't let the losing get him down. And I think, you know, like I said, he's a couple of years of maturity and one, you know, defensive rebounding piece at center away from getting the Jazz, you know, out of their tailspin and back up, you know, starting to climb the ladder again. So I think, you know, the Jazz are probably farther along maybe than the Clippers are, than the Lakers are, than maybe even the Warriors. So I think we'll start seeing them ascend out of the cellar pretty soon. And that lets us finish up with, right now, the worst team in the league, the Miami Heat, who are 5-32. And I think this is a team that is not as bad as its record indicates. The Heat do, they do a couple of things well. They're very good at blocking shots. They're actually pretty good in assists and in adjusted field goal percentage. They're not great, but they're not bad. Where they've been hurt has been in turnovers. They commit a lot of them, and they don't force very many of them. In fouls, where they foul a ton, and their free throw percentage has been atrocious. They're shooting 66% on the season, and that's hurting their ability to score. And I don't think this is what they had in mind when they put this team together. I know it was kind of a awkward transition year. They don't have a young player really to start building around, so they tried bringing in Chris Paul and Rudy Gay and Greg Oden and throwing together veterans who are still productive. Gary Perez is probably their best hope for the future, maybe along with Keith Pfeffer. Neither of them, I think, is going to be, dominating. So they've got future pieces, and I think this was kind of one last chance to stay respectable. Respectable. But at this point, the tank is on. You could try to reverse it, but at 5-32, you're already halfway through the season. Unless you go 32-5 coming out, you probably don't even have a shot at the playoffs. So, at this point, they've got all of their guys on expiring contracts except for their, for guys that are on rookie deals. So, this is a team that I can totally see, being at the start of those, 2 years in the wilderness where they're picking up draft picks. And then in year three and year four, they start being on the ascension again. And, the Heat have had success in the past, even in the recent past, as recently as 2015, they were in back-to-back conference finals and, winning division titles. So, it's one of those things where the team got old and now the Heat are, trying to deal with, okay, where do we go from here? And, they've set themselves up nicely to really start the reset in earnest next season. And, as long as they're losing this season and get a top pick, that's going to just help them, come back even faster. I think they're probably a year behind the Jazz because the Jazz already have a couple of players and they've done a pretty good job of clearing the decks. But, no reason to fret. The Heat, I'm sure, will be back in 2 to 3 seasons after they get the chance to make a couple of high draft picks and bring in the free agents they want to. And so there you have it. Those are all of your out-of-the-playoff teams. Obviously the Wizards and 76ers are technically in the lottery, but the Wizards are 4 games over 500. The 76ers are 6 games over 500. I think both of them have a very good chance of fighting their way into a playoff spot. So for all of the teams out there that say nobody ever talks about us because we're not very good, well, there you go. Somebody talked about you and is looking forward to see how you look on the way back up. I'm going to go ahead and wrap this podcast at just under an hour, which is probably a good thing. Everybody's getting sick of listening to me. And hopefully with the holidays behind me, I can get back to doing these on about a weekly basis. And it'll be fun because I think, we'll probably have the next one right around the time the trade deadline hits. Hopefully we'll see some big trades and we'll see how that shakes the league up. So that's it. Enjoy your new year. Good to have everybody along for the ride with us, and we'll close it out. This has been Taking It Slow, Episode 6.